All right, let's dive into a really fascinating but often overlooked part of World War II today, Northern Ireland. We're going to see how this, relatively small island found itself smack dab in the middle of this huge global conflict and the impact that that experience had on its identity for like decades afterwards.
It's interesting because when you think about Ireland during World War II, you think of neutrality, right? But Northern Ireland, they were right there with Britain. So you can imagine the tension,
Oh,
the
absolutely.
divided loyalties all playing out on one island.
It's like a powder keg.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've got some really cool sources that we're going to be digging into today. We've got firsthand accounts of the Belfast Blitz. We're going to look at the role of agriculture in Northern Ireland during the war, which is something I don't think a lot of people know much about.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And even a little peek into the political tensions that were kind of bubbling under the surface during this whole period.
I think by the end of this deep dive, listeners are going to be surprised by what they learn about Northern Ireland in World War II.
Me too.
They'll walk away not just knowing the timeline of events, but really understanding the human stories, the impact that this period had on the people who lived through it.
Okay, so let's set the stage, right? Let's go back to the 1920s and 30s in Northern Ireland. What was the political landscape like during that time?
Well, the guy who really looms large over this era is James Craig, the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. And, his famous quote, "A Protestant Parliament and a Protestant State." I mean, that really sums up the political reality of the time.
Yeah, it's a pretty stark statement, isn't it? Like, where does that leave anyone who doesn't fit into that very narrow definition?
And to really grasp the significance of Craig's statement, we need to consider its real-world impact. Like, it shed light on, for instance, discriminatory practices in housing and employment that really pushed the Catholic community to the margins.
So this wasn't just some abstract political ideology. This was having a direct impact on people's lives.
Yeah, this quote wasn't just rhetoric. It reflected the power structure that would have implications for years to come.
Okay, so knowing that, how did Northern Ireland respond when it became clear that another war was on the horizon?
Well, Craig, he was a staunch unionist. So he pledged full support to Britain right from the start.
Makes sense.
He offered up all of Northern Ireland's resources.
And just to remind our listeners, at this time, the rest of Ireland was neutral. So Northern Ireland really stands out.
It highlights this complicated relationship between Irish identity and loyalty, doesn't it? And even within Northern Ireland itself, there were divisions. I mean, Craig's push for conscription, just like in Britain, faced a lot of opposition from the nationalist community.
Of course,
Being forced to fight for a country that they didn't really feel a part of, it must have felt deeply unjust.
Absolutely. So is there like widespread support for the war effort in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's interesting because alongside that commitment to Britain, there was also this sense of complacency, maybe even a little bit of denial about the possibility of an attack.
Really? I mean, with a war raging in Europe,
I know, right?
you'd think the threat would feel pretty imminent.
You would think so. But even though Belfast, with the shipyards, all the industry, it was strategically important, the government, well, they were surprisingly unprepared for a potential attack.
So they just didn't see it coming? Or did they just choose to ignore it?
Well, it's a little of both, probably. Some unionist politicians, they seem to believe that Belfast was just too far away.
Too far away from Germany, you mean?
That it wouldn't be a target.
They underestimated the reach of the Luftwaffe.
They did. It's like they were blinded by this idea that, as part of the UK, you were safe.
So was there any effort made to, prepare for an air raid? Like, did they do anything?
There were some efforts, but looking back, they seem pretty inadequate. I mean, Richard Dawson Bates,
Who was he?
he was the Minister for Home Affairs. He actually ignored warnings from British defense experts.
Seriously.
About how vulnerable Belfast was.
That's pretty wild, isn't it?
Hard to imagine such a miscalculation, looking back now.
It makes you wonder what was going on in their minds at the time.
And even when they did take some steps, like, they set up the local defense volunteers, they installed a few anti-aircraft guns. It was way too little.
Too little, too late.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, especially tragic knowing what was about to happen.
Right.
I mean, the devastation of the Belfast Blitz,
yeah.
It's hard to even comprehend.
The accounts from that time, they're just devastating.
Yeah. So it's April 1941. The war has been going on for almost 2 years at this point.
Right.
And people in Belfast, I mean, they're still kind of clinging to this fragile sense of security.
They are.
But on the night of April 7th,
yeah,
the bombs started falling.
The first of the three major raids that would change the city forever.
Yeah, six Heinkel bombers.
Wow.
Targeting the Docklands.
Right.
Just unleashing all these high explosive and incendiary bombs.
Right into the night.
And the damage was immediate, right?
Right.
Part of Short's aircraft factory was badly damaged.
Yeah, it was a real blow to the city's industrial heart.
Like a wake-up call, right.
It was a wake-up call to the people of Belfast and to the Germans, you know.
What do you mean?
It showed them that Belfast was vulnerable.
Oh, okay.
A target that they could hit.
That's a chilling realization.
Yeah.
And sadly, it was just the beginning.
Just the taste of what was to come.
Yeah, because a little over a week later, on Easter Tuesday.
Right.
Belfast faces the full fury of the Luftwaffe.
Yeah, the Easter Raid.
Yeah.
The deadliest of the three.
This is the one that everyone remembers, I think.
Absolutely. 180 German bombers.
180.
180.
That's incredible.
Over 200 tons of explosives.
Wow.
Raining down on the city.
And they weren't just targeting military targets this time, right?
No. Residential areas were hit.
Indiscriminately.
Indiscriminately.
We've got accounts from survivors describing bombs falling within 15 to 20 yards of one another.
It's hard to imagine the terror of that night.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? It's just unbelievable.
The damage was catastrophic. The water supply was destroyed. Ships under construction at Harland and Wolff.
The famous Harland and Wolff shipyards.
Right. They were destroyed and countless homes reduced to rubble.
And the death toll.
Yeah.
900 people.
Unthinkable.
Far exceeding anything that the government had planned for.
It really exposed their lack of preparation.
It's just tragic.
You know, the morgues were overwhelmed. They had to lay the bodies out in St. George's Market for identification. It's a stark reminder of the human cost of this miscalculation.
It's a reminder that even during a war, right?
Yeah.
Decisions made by those in power have real consequences for ordinary people.
They do.
But in the midst of all this chaos and devastation, there's this incredible story of humanity and compassion that emerges.
It's the story of Eamon de Valera.
Who was that?
He was the Taoiseach of Ireland.
Okay.
Now remember, Ireland was neutral.
Right.
But when he heard about the Belfast Blitz, he sent fire crews across the border to help.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was an act of defiance and solidarity that transcended those political divides.
I mean, what an incredible gesture.
Yeah. You can imagine the pressure that he must have been under.
Right.
But he chose compassion over political expediency.
So tell me more about that. What actually happened?
Well, the fires were raging in Belfast.
Right.
And the authorities there, they were overwhelmed.
Okay.
So they sent this desperate plea for help to Dublin.
Uh-huh.
And De Valera, he didn't even hesitate.
Wow.
13 fire engines, 71 volunteers.
Wow.
Raced north from Dundalk, Drogheda, Dublin, Dunleher.
That must have been a powerful sight.
It was. It was a symbol of unity.
Yeah.
In the face of unimaginable suffering.
Right. It's like this reminder that even in war, human connection can prevail.
Absolutely. And, you know, they couldn't do much because the water supply was damaged.
Right.
But their presence was this incredible gesture of solidarity.
And compassion.
And compassion.
Makes you wonder what could have been possible if that spirit had persisted.
Right.
But unfortunately, the Belfast Blitz wasn't over just yet.
There was still one more major raid to come.
Yeah, the third and final raid came on the night of May 4th.
Right.
Again, they targeted the shipyards, industrial areas.
At this point, a lot of residents had fled the city.
Yeah, our sources talk about, you know, thousands of people fleeing every night. They called them ditchers.
Yeah, it must have been terrifying.
So this third raid resulted in fewer casualties, thankfully.
Around 200 people were killed.
Yeah.
Still a horrific number, of course.
Of course.
But the damage to the city's infrastructure was extensive.
Harland and Wolff was hit again.
They were. And Short's factory as well. War production was severely disrupted.
It's just amazing to think about the scale of destruction in such a short period of time.
Over 100,000 people were left homeless.
Wow.
Over half the city's housing was damaged or destroyed.
And the financial cost must have been enormous.
It was. They estimated about 20 million in damage at the time.
Wow.
It's hard to even fathom.
Yeah, so these raids were a turning point for Northern Ireland.
Right.
They shattered any remaining illusion of safety.
It exposed the government's lack of preparation.
Yeah, and they left this deep scar on the city and its people, physically and psychologically.
The trauma of the Blitz lingered long after the bombs stopped falling.
But amid all this devastation, there's another side to the story that we need to explore.
What's that?
Northern Ireland's incredible contribution to the Allied war effort.
Oh, yeah, that's an important part of the story.
It's a story that often gets overlooked.
It does. But it's one of resilience and determination.
It really deserves to be told.
And it starts with what Northern Ireland was already known for shipbuilding.
Right. Harland and Wolff.
Those iconic shipyards.
Despite being bombed, they managed to keep producing warships and merchant vessels.
At an incredible pace.
Yeah, they built 131 ships for the Royal Navy.
Repaired countless others.
And overall, Belfast shipyards contributed over 3,000 vessels to the war effort.
That's remarkable, especially considering the challenges.
And it wasn't just ships.
Yeah.
Aircraft production at Short and Harland, they were hitting the Blitz too.
They were, but they also played a vital role.
Yeah, building over 1,200 bomber planes.
Including the iconic Stirling bomber.
And then there's the linen industry, which boomed during the war.
Providing uniforms and materials for the troops.
It's amazing to think that the fabric from Northern Ireland might have clothed soldiers fighting all over Europe.
That's a powerful image, isn't it?
Yeah, it connects this small island to this global conflict.
And it does.
And we can't forget the farmers.
Oh, yeah, the unsung heroes.
They actually exceeded their agricultural production targets.
They did. The government set targets for each region to increase food production.
And Northern Ireland was the only region to actually meet its target.
And they exceeded it in some cases.
Wow, how'd they do that?
They really put everything into it. They converted unused land, even sports pitches, golf courses, into farmland.
Wow, they really stepped up.
They understood the importance of food security.
So they're feeding the troops, supplying materials.
Yeah.
It really highlights how deeply involved they were in the war effort.
And beyond those direct contributions, their location was also vital.
Their strategic location.
Yeah, their ports and airfields were essential for the Royal Navy, the RAF.
Right, and even for the U.S. troops preparing for D-Day.
Exactly. There were over 120,000 American troops stationed in Northern Ireland at one point.
Yeah, that's a huge number.
And General Eisenhower himself acknowledged their crucial role.
He said the D-Day invasion wouldn't have been possible without them.
It's a powerful statement.
It is. And to kind of underscore that point,
yeah.
The surrender of the German U-boat fleet took place off the coast of County Derry.
A symbolic end to the Battle of the Atlantic.
What a fitting tribute to their contribution.
It is.
I mean, all of this happening against the backdrop of the Blitz,
right.
The political tensions.
The uncertainty of wartime.
It says a lot about the people of Northern Ireland.
It does. It's a story of resilience and determination.
It's incredible.
It is.
But as we know, war always leaves behind a complex legacy.
It does.
So what were those lasting impacts of the war on Northern Ireland?
Well, that's a question that takes us deep into the heart of Northern Ireland's story.
Okay.
And to really understand it, we need to explore the post-war years, the rise of the welfare state,
okay.
And the shifting relationship between North and South.
Sounds like we're about to uncover even more fascinating layers to this story.
We are, and I think you'll find the journey just as intriguing as the destination.
I'm ready.
Let's go.
We were talking about the legacy of World War II on Northern Ireland. It feels like the war kind of had this ripple effect, touching so many aspects of life on the island.
Yeah. It did.
So where do we even begin to unpack all of that?
Well, let's start with the welfare state.
Right.
Because that's something that really took root during this period.
So remind me, what was the context for that? Why did the welfare state become such a big deal after the war?
Well, the war had really, you know, exposed these deep social inequalities.
Right.
And there was this growing sense that the government needed to do more to support its citizens. You know.
So it wasn't just about rebuilding bombed out cities.
Exactly.
It was about creating a more just society.
Right. The war created this real momentum for change.
Okay.
I mean, think about the Goveridge Report.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
It was published in 1942, right in the middle of the war.
Right.
And it laid the groundwork for what would become the welfare state.
Okay. So for our listener who might not be super familiar with that term, can you break down what exactly the welfare state meant for people in Northern Ireland?
Sure. Imagine a safety net, you know,
okay.
Designed to catch people when they fall on hard times.
Okay.
It provided benefits for the unemployed, the sick, the elderly, anyone who couldn't support themselves.
So a real safety net for the most vulnerable.
Exactly.
That's a huge shift from, you know, the pre-war era where people often relied on charity or family if they couldn't work.
It was a huge shift, and it had a profound impact.
Give me some examples. What kind of specific programs or initiatives were put in place?
Well, one of the most significant was the creation of the National Health Service.
The NHS.
The NHS, right? Yeah. In 1948.
Okay.
So for the first time, people had access to free health care.
Regardless of their income.
Exactly.
That's something we often take for granted today. The idea that health care is a right, not a privilege.
It was a revolutionary idea.
Yeah.
And it had a particularly big impact in Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, poverty and deprivation were really widespread there.
Right.
So the NHS really helped to level the playing field.
So in a way, the war, with all its horrors, had this unintended consequence of pushing for a more just and compassionate society.
It did. The welfare state also expanded access to education and housing.
Okay.
Creating opportunities for people who might have been excluded before.
It sounds pretty utopian.
In some ways, it was a real vision of a fairer, more equitable society.
But I'm guessing not everyone was on board with these changes.
You're right. There was some pushback.
What were their concerns? Why would anyone oppose the idea of a social safety net?
Well, some unionists, especially those from more conservative backgrounds, they worried that the welfare state was a step towards socialism.
I see.
They fear it would erode individual responsibility.
But then it would create a culture of dependency.
Right. And there were economic concerns, too.
Like what?
Some people worried that the cost of these programs would stifle economic growth.
Okay, so even within the unionist community,
there were debates about the role of government and, you know, the balance between individual freedom and collective responsibility.
Exactly, and those debates often played out along sectarian lines.
Right, so it becomes entangled with the existing political and religious divisions in Northern Ireland.
It does. It's important to acknowledge those complexities.
Absolutely.
The welfare state wasn't perfect, but it did represent a significant step forward.
Okay, so we've talked about social change, but we also need to address the elephant in the room. The political impact of the war, especially on the relationship between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Right, the war really highlighted the diverging paths.
Yeah, the North standing with Britain, enduring the Blitz, contributing to the war effort.
Well, the South remained neutral, forging its own path.
I imagine that created some tension, maybe even resentment between the two.
It did. The South's neutrality, while understandable given its history, created a sense of distance, you know, a growing separation. It almost feels like a missed opportunity, especially after De Valera's gesture during the Blitz.
It was a powerful symbol of unity, but it couldn't erase the political realities.
Of partition, the different wartime experiences.
The contrasting visions for the future.
And the British government's actions after the war probably didn't help.
No, they didn't.
What did they do?
Well, in 1949, they passed the Ireland Act.
Okay.
Which formally guaranteed that Northern Ireland would remain part of the UK unless a majority of its parliament voted otherwise.
So they basically slammed the door shut on any possibility of a united Ireland.
It was a clear message that the British government had no intention of letting go.
So the war, in a way, strengthened Northern Ireland's ties to Britain, but also deepened the divide with the South.
It's a complicated legacy, isn't it?
It is. It's like a bittersweet outcome.
The war had these really profound and often unintended consequences for this small island.
Shaping its political landscape and its relationships for decades to come.
Yeah, it's a reminder that events in one place can have these ripple effects across the world.
It really makes you think about the interconnectedness of everything.
It does.
But before we move on, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the incredible resilience of the people of Northern Ireland.
Absolutely.
They endured so much hardship, but they came out of the war with a renewed sense of purpose.
It's a recurring theme in this story.
The shipyard workers, the farmers, the families rebuilding their lives from the rubble.
It's a testament to the human spirit.
Our ability to find hope, even in the darkest of times.
Absolutely.
Speaking of hope, what about the economic landscape after the war? We talked about the wartime boom, but was there a post-war slump?
Well, it's a bit complicated.
Okay.
There was definitely a period of adjustment as those wartime contracts dried up.
Right. Makes sense.
Some industries, like shipbuilding, they saw a decline.
Yeah.
But others, like textiles and engineering, they continued to do well.
So it was a mixed bag.
It was.
Some sectors struggling, while others adapted.
Yeah. And the government played a role in this transition, too.
How so?
Well, they recognized the need to diversify the economy.
Okay.
They implemented programs to attract new industries, promote investment.
Makes sense.
They invested in infrastructure, education, training.
Trying to create a more skilled workforce.
Exactly. And make Northern Ireland more attractive to businesses.
So it sounds like a combination of economic forces and government policies helped shape their post-war recovery.
It was. And while there were definitely challenges, overall, Northern Ireland did pretty well in those post-war years.
But I'm guessing those deeper social and political issues didn't just disappear?
Unfortunately not. That's where we see those old divisions resurfacing.
Okay.
The war had brought about some social progress, but it hadn't erased the underlying tensions between unionists and nationalists.
So the progress made during the war, that sense of shared purpose, it started to unravel.
Yeah, in some ways.
Okay.
The political landscape remained largely unchanged. The Unionist Party continued to dominate.
Excluding nationalists from power.
Yeah, and that exclusion fueled resentment and anger.
Especially considering the sacrifices that many had made during the war.
Right. The memory of the South's neutrality lingered.
Right.
And discriminatory practices persisted.
So even with economic growth and the benefits of the welfare state.
Yeah.
Those old wounds, those inequalities, they were still there.
They were. And as we move into the latter half of the 20th century, we're going to see how those tensions erupt into a period of intense conflict.
The Troubles.
The Troubles, exactly.
The dark and complex chapter in Northern Ireland's history.
It is. And it underscores the challenges of building a truly inclusive and peaceful society.
It's a reminder that progress isn't always linear.
It's not.
That even after a shared experience like war, the road to reconciliation can be long and difficult.
It can be.
Mm.
But understanding the historical roots of conflict, the complexities of identity, that's crucial if we want to learn from the past.
And build a better future.
And that's what makes these deep dives so important, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They allow us to grapple with these tough questions.
And gain a deeper understanding of the forces that shape our world.
Exactly.
It feels like we're heading into some choppy waters as we get into the second half of the 20th century in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, buckle up.
Because we're about to dive into the Troubles.
Yeah, a really, really difficult period.
A period of intense conflict that, you know, left a deep scar on Northern Ireland.
It did.
It's hard to believe that just a few decades after a world war.
Yeah.
This small island would be embroiled in another prolonged conflict.
It's a tragic chapter for sure. And while we can't get into all the details today,
right.
I think it's important to see how the themes we've been discussing, you know, the division, the struggle for equality, identity,
yeah,
they all kind of came together to create the conditions for the Troubles.
So how did these seeds of conflict, which we know were there long before the war.
Right.
How did they actually sprout in the decades that followed?
Well, imagine a society where, you know, despite some progress, deep inequalities persist.
Okay.
The Unionist government, they made some reforms, but not enough to address the concerns of the nationalist community.
They were still excluded from power.
Largely, yeah.
Facing discrimination.
In housing, employment, all areas of life.
It's like the war created this brief opportunity for change, but then that window closed.
Yeah. And those old resentments, they resurfaced.
And then the civil rights movement starts gaining momentum in the 1960s.
Right. Demanding equal rights, an end to discrimination.
It was such a powerful force for change around the world.
It was.
It makes sense that it would have a big impact on Northern Ireland, too.
It did. But the Unionist establishment, they were afraid of losing power.
Right.
They resisted, often violently, to suppress the movement.
That's a familiar pattern throughout history, isn't it?
It is. Those in power are clinging to the status quo.
Even when it means oppression.
Sadly, yes.
And in Northern Ireland, this clash between the desire for equality and the resistance to change, it ignited the Troubles.
It did. It was like a tinderbox waiting for a spark.
And the war, despite those moments of unity we talked about, it might have actually made things worse.
I think it did. It exacerbated those existing tensions.
So for a listener who might not know much about this period, can you kind of paint a picture of what the Troubles were like?
Imagine a society divided along religious and political lines.
Okay.
Where fear and violence are just part of everyday life.
That's a scary thought.
It was a scary reality for a lot of people.
So nationalists, who were mostly Catholic.
Right.
They wanted civil rights and a united Ireland.
Yeah.
And Unionists, who were mostly Protestant,
right.
They wanted to stay part of the UK.
Exactly. It was about identity, belonging, the struggle for power.
It's heartbreaking to see how these deep divisions led to so much violence.
It was a very complex conflict with no easy answers.
And it shows how the wounds of history can run really deep.
They do.
It's not enough to just end the violence.
No, you have to address the root causes, the injustices.
We have to find ways to bridge those divides.
It's a long and difficult process.
And it's a reminder that leadership matters.
It does.
That those in power have a responsibility to promote justice and inclusivity.
Not division and fear.
Right.
The Troubles cast a long shadow over Northern Ireland.
But the story doesn't end there.
Right, it doesn't. The people of Northern Ireland are resilient.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of progress towards peace in recent decades.
That's good to hear. It's a reminder that even after darkness, there's hope for healing.
There is.
So going back to our original question.
Yeah.
How did World War II and everything that came after
right.
shape Northern Ireland's identity?
It's a big question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the war definitely strengthened their bond with Britain.
Solidified their place in the UK.
Yeah. It brought social change, the welfare state, economic opportunities.
But it also deepened those divisions.
It did. And that contributed to the conflict that followed.
It's a story of contradictions.
It is. Progress and setbacks, unity and division.
Hope and despair.
It reminds us that history isn't simple. A tapestry of choices, experiences, struggles.
It's incredible to think about the resilience of the human spirit, you know?
Yeah.
Our capacity for both compassion and destruction.
It's a powerful thing.
We've been on quite a journey through this pivotal period in Northern Ireland's history.
We have.
And it's shaped the region we know today.
It has.
It really makes you think about the importance of understanding history.
It does.
Learning from the past, working towards a bolder future.
Beautifully said.
So, to wrap things up, I just want to say thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Northern Ireland during World War II.
It's been a pleasure.
It's a story that reminds us that the past is never really past, you know?
It's always with us.
It shapes the present and the future.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning.
Keep seeking out those hidden stories that connect us all.